Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Tonight's guest is legendary gambling author Arnold Snyder, talking about his book, Poker Tournament Formula 2. Apparently, we did not scare him too much last week, so he's paying us a return visit. We'll be talking to Arnold shortly. Recently, I heard of a sharing arrangement among four professional gamblers who respected and trusted each other. It was a video poker promotion that included both a juicy point multiplier and you earn drawing tickets for a giveaway. The players all agreed to play about the same amount. They would keep the slot club points they earned, but would equally share the results of their play and the results of the drawing. One of the foursome hit a $20,000 royal early, which is always nice for the team. And when another player after the $20,000 royal was hit, he was about to start. Casino management came up to him and told him he was not eligible for either the point multiplier or the drawing. All four players thought the promotion was open to everybody when they made the deal, but when Joe showed up, for whatever reason, he wasn't allowed to participate. The question now becomes, how much of the net win or loss, if any, should Joe get? Before I tell you what the group decided, think about what you would have decided if you were in such a deal. Prize-splitting deals are not that rare. Figuring out in advance how to deal with these things is important. The group decided to let Joe have a full share. He showed up ready to go. He had no reason to believe he would become uninvited, and the group decided this right away before they knew the final score. The group was ahead at the moment, but it didn't have to stay that way. Now, I agree with this decision. How about you, Michael? What do you think you would have done if you were in this?
I agree with the decision, too, and I've been in this kind of situation before, but it was always discussed in advance, the contingency that if somebody had to pull out, that he was still responsible for his share of the action up until the point that he found out that he was out of it. And furthermore, sometimes we would make an adjustment that he would actually, in this case, get actually even more money, assuming that you were playing a negative expected value game, because here he was taking on this negative play, so he should also be rewarded a little bit for that too.
Well, it turns out that with the multiplier, this was not a negative, and he didn't even start. But anyway, you can never cover all the contingencies beforehand. However many you cover, there can be extras. Now, Arnold, you must have had something similar in blackjack sharing events years ago.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've seen similar type things happen with blackjack teams. Blackjack teams are usually based on investment dollars and then time that players put into the tables, and sometimes exactly what they're doing with certain types of players getting more or less. So they're usually more complicated than just, you know, four people just doing the exact same thing. In this case, every player would have had, technically or at least thought they had, the same investment. I'm assuming they were all playing with their own money, and they didn't like pool some certain amount of money just to get through this.
Correct.
Whereas blackjack teams usually have to pool money because they need to each take large amounts in and, you know, in and out of the casinos. It's similar to I've seen team situations where a player gets barred. In a case where it's simply hours, if a player stops playing, he's not going to get paid for the hours. And there's just really basically the way it goes. However, if he has an investment share in the team, he will get his investment share. I agree with you and Michael that I would have just made a four-way split with this guy, since he was essentially willing to put in his full investment share and his full-time share, and this just came out of nowhere. I think I would have agreed with that decision.
All right, so we're in agreement.
And let me add that I've been in lots of situations where just unforeseen things happen, and they do happen. And I think that it's important that when you enter into agreements with other players like this, that you pick good people and people that you can trust and people that are not selfish. Because I've also known people that if there was ever any kind of an ambiguity, they would always put themselves first and think, okay, how can I, you know, argue my case as the best way possible? No, I think that you should actually look at it from someone else's point of view and give the other person every possible benefit of the doubt and bend to go their way a little bit, because I think that's the moral thing to do, and I think that will be good for the friendship and a good long-term strategy.
Good. I'm in agreement with you, and I'm glad I get to screw up a little bit before you bail on me. I think that's great. All right. Now, we received an email at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com asking about certain craps sucker bets, namely craps or small and tall, sharpshooter, among others. Now, these side bets in craps are usually not relevant to anybody attempting to gamble with an edge. Michael, these probably are all covered on your website. Why don't you tell our listeners how to go about finding the answer on your website?
Side bets are one of my specialties. Number one, they're easy to analyze. And number two, players ask about them all the time. So in craps, if you scroll to the bottom of my craps page, there's a link that says craps variants and side bets. And click on that, and that will tell you about the small, tall, the fire bet, crapless craps, you know, all the kind of craps.
All the crappy bets you can
make. Yes, all the crappy craps bets. And same thing with blackjack. At the bottom of my blackjack page, I have at least 20 appendices and other documents relating to craps. And blackjack appendix 8 is all about side bets. And I have dozens and dozens of them. And they're all listed alphabetically at the top. So click whichever one you're interested in, and I'll take you right there and show you what I have to say on it.
Your website is a huge resource for all people interested in gambling with an edge.
But the short answer is side bets are sucker bets, so unless you have some advantage play, leave them alone.
In the World Series of Poker, the most interesting result of the week was Alan Joffrey Shulman winning the $1,000 seniors event with over 4,000 players. Now, she is the wife of card player publisher Barry Shulman and the mother, or possibly stepmother, of Jeff Happy Shulman, both of whom are successful players, and they both final tabled about a week and a half ago in other events. So three members of the same family final tabled. I don't think this has happened before. There was some friendly debate if this accomplishment mean the Shulmans have replaced the Brunsons as the first family of poker. My vote, if I had one, would be no, but this is still a remarkable year for the Shulmans. My next semester of free video poker classes will begin Tuesday, July 10th, 1 p.m. at Samstown. The full schedule may be found on bobdancer.com. Last week, I was in Atlantic City, and I stopped by the Revel, which is the newest and brightest and no smokingest casino in Atlantic City. Shaq and I have a $100 bet as to whether they will still be at least 50% non-smoking by the end of 2013. I'm betting the no. Now, I heard they're in trouble and aren't getting much business. This was definitely not true last weekend. It could take up to 2 hours just to get a slot club card because the lines were so long. The reason is that they are buying their business. If you have a 7-star card at Harrah's or whatever the equivalent rating is at the MGM Mirage, they're giving you $750 in free play, $250 right away, and $500 a week or more later. Since there were 2007 star people in town, a bunch of us went to the Revel for the easy pickings. Even if we weren't going to come back a week later for the remaining $500, $250 in free play isn't bad. If you have lesser statuses at other casinos, you get lesser amounts, but you still get something. So the lines are long, especially on the weekends. My guess is they're not going to keep these players, and that whoever thought of this multi-million dollar giveaway will be looking for a new job soon. But if you are in the Atlantic City area, it's a smart play to take advantage of this. Michael, why don't you tell us about Arnold Snyder?
Arnold Snyder is our guest tonight. He is one of the biggest names in the world of gambling, and deservedly so. For years, he was one of the biggest names in the world of blackjack. He's a founding member of the Blackjack Hall of Fame, written a number of books on blackjack, all of them outstanding. One of my favorite is The Big Book of Blackjack. But lately, Arnold has turned his attention to poker, and he wrote two books, Poker Tournament Formula 1 and 2, and we're going to be mainly talking about those books. These books are outstanding, and they're very readable, unlike most poker books, which are one hand analysis after another and a lot of math. Poker Tournament Formula gives it to you in plain, simple English, and it's something that everyone will enjoy reading. And it's I think they're great books. So, Arnold, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Nice to be here.
Poker Tournament Formula 2. The primary breakthrough in that is speaks of utility. This is largely how many chips you have compared to the size of the big blind and to the other players. Why is this so important, and why is the subject ignored by so many players?
Well, it hasn't been totally ignored. I don't know that I've read other poker books that use the term utility. Maybe some have been written since mine. Utility really means, to me, the ability to use your chips. If you have a lot of chips, you have a lot of utility. If you have very few chips, you have very little utility. And what this means is, for instance, if you're a short stack at a table and the blinds are coming around, and you, let's say you only have five or six big blinds left and there's already antes in the pot, technically, you have to make a move, and you really only have one play. You're going to push all in before the flop. And that's really the only play you can make. Whereas if you're sitting there with, you know, say 50,000 in chips and the blinds are, you know, 100, 200, you have a lot of utility. You can see whatever flops you want to see. You can make position plays. You can make bluffs. And if they don't work, you can afford the loss. You can call players just for information. You can bet for information. You can put a bet out there just to see, does this guy really have a hand, or is he just making a continuation bet? You can make a continuation bet. If you raise before the flop and the flop doesn't hit you, you can still come out betting like you have a hand. You can afford to do these things. When you have the fewer chips you have, the less of these poker moves you can make. A lot of these would be moves in any kind of a poker game, but especially in an all-in poker game. And some of these are really things that really are only applied to tournaments. Utility itself is much more of a function in tournaments than it is in a cash game. And the reason is, in a cash game, if you're short on chips, say you can buy more chips. No, you don't have to sit there with fewer chips than anybody else at the table. Therefore, that whole concept of utility is very different. In a poker tournament, if you win a lot of chips from somebody, you crush their utility. And they can't get more chips. The only way they can get chips is to win chips. And when your utility is low, it's hard to win chips. So to me, this is a concept that hasn't been dealt with in other poker books much. But to me, this is the essence of what makes a tournament a good value for people who understand this.
Now, in the World Series of Poker, there's always prop bets. Once it gets to the final table, futures bets on who's going to win. And in Pinnacle, you can bet against people to win. And I think you're going to disagree with this, but my basic strategy is your probability of winning is proportional to your stack. And I have made what I perceive to be very good value bets, betting against the big names that were short stacked. What's your opinion on that?
I would tend to bet against short stacks also. I think betting on a name that has a short stack is probably not the best way to play. Again, I've never tried any of these prop bets, you know, betting on tournament players, but I actually agree with the way you're doing it. And the reason is the players with more chips have more utility. They can play more poker. The short stacks really are very limited in what they can do, and they're really hoping to double up or triple up or quadruple up depending on how short they are. And that is basically going to be a function of their cards holding up when they do go all in.
Now, there was a situation two or three years ago where I think it was Darwin Moon had, say, 30% of the chips and Phil Ivey had 3%. So how big of a favorite would you have made Darwin Moon over Phil Ivey?
In other words, other players were sharing the other 67%
yes.
of the chips. I would put Darwin Moon as a very big favorite over Phil Ivey, having only 3% of the chips. Were there six players at this point?
I think it was
5%
of the chips, and so the fair price was 19-1, and the actual betting came out to be 10-1 or something against him. You'd have to lay, because he had 5% of the Ivey, and he is generally considered to be the best player in the world.
There might be arguments as to who the best player in the world is. Nobody.
He's in the discussion.
Nobody would ever argue against his being an extremely talented player. And if he was in a field of very weak players, I don't know that he would ever be the favorite, but he would certainly have a whole lot more possibility of winning than he would against a table full of very knowledgeable good players. The thing is that the more chips you have, and this is especially true at a final table, the greater your probability of winning. And if somebody has, if an equivalently talented player had 30% of the chips and Phil Ivey had 3% of the chips, I would say that equivalently talented player would have more than a 10-1 advantage on winning that.
Would you care to throw out a figure?
No.
Okay.
It's very complicated because so much then depends on what do the other players have. If you start talking about two players and there's only two players left and mm-hmm. this one has this percentage and that one has that percentage, it really comes down to the ability of the players to play poker. If they're close in chips and the blinds and antes aren't so high that they don't have to play all in, then they're just playing poker. Utility starts playing into it when one player has to start saying, well, I can't call for information here. I'd like to know what he's betting here, but I can't just throw the chips out to see his cards. Whereas when both players have a lot of chips, a lot of times players will. They'll bet for information. They'll just say, well, I'm going to throw a bet out here, see if he can call this. You can't do that when you're short stacked. And these are the types of plays that Phil Ivey would be making because he's an extremely talented player. And so he would be using every move he could. If he's on a short stack, he's going to be just like anybody else with a short stack. He's got to make his all-in move and hope it holds up.
Okay. On another topic, you mentioned in the Poker Tournament Formula 2 that modern bluffing theory was strongly influenced by the 1944 book on game theory, Theory of Games and Economic Behavior by John von Neumann and Oscar Mortgenstern. The book attempted to get at the essence of poker by simplifying it down to a game of poker where each player just got one card. And in your book, you say that this book has had a huge influence on modern bluffing theory, and you think that it's incorrectly applied. Can you tell us more what you have to say on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, von Neumann's book, I think, what was it? Theory of Games and Economics or something like that.
Theory of Games and Economic Behavior.
Oh, and Economic Behavior. It really was a book about economics. It was not a book about poker. He never mentioned anything about an actual poker game. He has a chapter in there called Poker and Bluffing, in which he invented a very simplistic poker game. Each player gets one card. This is not a regular deck of cards. This is a deck of cards where every card has a value on it from 1 to 52. And the high card wins. Each player gets, there's no drawing, you bet after you see your cards. In other words, I think you have to put in a bet beforehand, and then after you get your cards, you can bet. Obviously, if you have a card valued from 1 to 26, you're below average. If you have it from 27 to 52, you're above average. A very simplistic strategy somebody might come up with would be, well, if my cards are 27 or higher, I'm going to bet, and if they're 26 or lower, I'm not going to bet. This would become immediately obvious to your opponent, however, who could then start stealing pots from you, because when you're not betting, he could bet, and if you assume he's using your strategy, he's going to kill you. So what von Neumann did was he came up with a formula to show what percentage of the time in this type of a game would a player be his optimal betting strategy. What percentage of time would he bluff, and what percentage of time would he call bluffs from the other player? And basically, these are the same percentage, and if both players are playing the same percentage, they're going to break even in the game. It's like a coin flip. But if the other player doesn't understand what percentage to bluff and doesn't know what percentage you're bluffing, and he either is bluffing too much or not enough or not calling bluffs enough, then you're going to kill that player because you know the perfect percentage of time to do this. Well, this really has very little to do with an actual poker game. And because, first of all, there's nothing like image. Neither of these players has a strong image or a weak image or anything. This was just a mathematical formula he figured out as to what would be the best strategy in this particularly weird game that he called poker. And the only reason he called it poker was because the best hand was going to win, and you could bluff, and he was trying to figure out what would be the best bluffing strategy.
So did he say that you should bluff in proportion to how weak your hand was?
No. What he said was you should bluff at random times. And this is what he came up with as the best strategy would be to pick random times to bluff, to not bluff based on what your cards were.
Well, I meant that his chances of bluffing were higher or in proportion to how weak his card was.
I don't actually recall, you know, all the details of what he wrote in there. And in fact, it's so mathematically complex, I guarantee you there are very few poker players that ever read von Neumann's chapter and said, oh, I get it, this is how to bluff. It's extremely complicated. And it has, from my perspective, it has almost nothing to do with the game of poker.
And so your theory of bluffing deals with kind of intuitive clues you pick up at the table as to what's going on and things like that.
Well,
is that right?
It's like this. The problem with bluffing at random, and this is what has screwed up players. If you pick a random, something random to decide when to bluff, you are most likely going to be read by your opponents. The best players essentially call bluffs when a bet just doesn't look right. There are no poker games where everybody gets one card, looks at it, and then each player makes one bet and either calls or folds. There's none that exists. Poker is a series of bets, and a hand kind of tells a story, and players watch the story unfold. They see what happens, you know, what happens when he, for instance, if we just take Hold'em, how does he play before the flop when he sees his cards? How does he play after the flop? How does he play on the turn? How's he playing on the river? And you can see the story unfolding. Well, the best bluffs look like you are telling a story that makes sense. And you're going to get called if you look like all of a sudden you just came out with a bet and the guy is scratching his head going, I don't believe that bet. What the heck just happened? Why is he making that bet? And this, in fact, is a very poor way to bluff. You should bluff only when it looks like, okay, that card came down, I think he might have hit his flush. It looked like he was calling for the flush, or he looked like he was calling for the straight. Or, in other words, it has to look like something happened that suddenly gives you the right to come out with a bet that doesn't look like the rest of the game. And to just say, pick a random interval, like, you know, well, if the turn card is a heart, I'm gonna push all in. You know, that's just kind of a crazy thing to do, unless the heart would have made the flush, and somehow you think you're a play. In other words, you can't just say something random and suddenly make a bet, or you're going to find yourself up against pros who can just read you like a book. They're just going to go, this guy said, they look at how nervous you are making the bet. They're going to look at the sweat in your brow. They're going to, you know, or the way you're trying to act strong. You know, just they're going to look at so many things. If they've been sitting at a poker table with you for a couple hours and all of a sudden you're doing something that's just unusual, they're going to call. And in fact, if you're a really good bluffer and you can actually play an incredibly strong hand and then make it look like you're just taking a shot, you might get a call. But that's something totally different from what von Neumann was saying.
Let's go back to utility. Dan Harrington is a highly respected poker player and writer. His books are considered to be the Bible for tournament players. That makes your book either the New Testament or total heresy. I'm not sure. How is your concept of utility similar or different to Harrington's concept of M?
Okay, Harrington's concept of M. M has to do with how many rounds of play you have left based on your chip stack, looking at the blinds and annies, okay? And look at it like this. Let's say the small blind's 100, the big blind's 200, and the ante is $25, and there's 10 players at the table. A round of play is going to cost you $550. One big blind, one small blind, and 10 times 25 is $550. If you're sitting there with $5,500, you have an M of 10. Okay, you have to understand this before we can start talking about.
Okay,
you know, we need to know what M is. If you have 55,000 chips, well, then you have an M of 100. Your M is very high. You could sit there for a long time and not play a hand, and you're still going to be alive in the game. If your M is only 10, well, essentially you can go around that table 10 times, but your chips are going to be dwindling $550 each round, and you're going to get blinded off within 10 times around the table. So that's what M is. M has nothing whatsoever to do with utility. It has to do with your survival, and it has to do with, and I don't disagree with an awful lot of Dan Harrington's writing, and even his concept of M. I understand what he's doing. He basically says, when your M gets low, and as it goes lower, and he has like a green zone, an orange zone, a yellow zone, a red zone, where which has to do with how many M you have in your stack. He says, as it goes down, you are going to have to play more marginal hands, and you're going to have to play more aggressively and take shots because your chips are they're getting too low. But essentially, you're going to play more marginal hands. Whereas, say, you might not play an ace eight off suit when you've got an M of 60. You might decide to push all in with that hand when you have an M of 6, because at this point, that single ace in your hand is one of the stronger hands that you're going to see before you're blinded off.
But an M of 100 would correspond to you having high utility, wouldn't it?
It would, except that Harrington doesn't talk much about utility. With an M of 100, his general strategy would be to play very conservative, to conserve your chips. Whereas, to me, in a tournament, having a high M, and I don't actually use the concept of M in my book. I actually talk about how many big blinds you have left, uh-huh. which is similar in a way. For the players, to me, the tournament players, that really are most successful are those who, when they have a lot of chips, they play more hands, they play looser, they get involved in more pots because they can afford it. And they want to mix it up with players. They want to see if they can steal. They want to, you know, they want to make plays that are going to make them chips. And especially when they have more chips than other players, they want to scare them out of pots. They want to steal pots. And to me, that's the more proper way to play a tournament.
Very good.
Okay. So speaking of being read like a book, in your book you say, nothing scares a player more than an opponent who seems to be reading him like a book. Letting an opponent know that you can read him is one of the nastiest things you can do with a smile. And I know somebody who does this to me. He was on our show 2 weeks ago, and once in a while I have a friendly poker game at my house, and I always invite him, and it doesn't take long for him to make a remark like, I bet Mike just had Queen 10 in that hand, and he's right practically every time. And it really frustrates me, but I don't think it's like a nasty thing to say. I interpret it more as like a...
He's showing off.
Yeah, like he's showing off, but he's also like telling me, Mike, you know, this is a weakness in your game. Maybe you should do something about it. And so what is my proper reaction to that? And do you quickly have any advice to people that know they're being read like a book?
Well, first of all, it's probably too late. You shouldn't have told him that he's reading you like a book. And if he's listening, well, it's too late, Michael.
He's working tonight. I think we're safe.
Okay. Well, this may be something you've communicated to him before. I don't know.
Well, he probably could tell by the look on my face
that you're right.
That he was right.
It's very scary for a player to feel that somebody else, especially when you're talking about a hand like, say, Queen 10 offsuit. If he says something like, oh, I'll bet you had a small pocket pair, and it's something where you came in with a kind of a big bet before the flop, and the flop came down with high cards, and he bet, and you just threw your hand. He might say, well, I'll bet you had a you know, and in many cases, something like that, that, you know, you can see the logic to that kind of a thing. Or you can think, well, I'll bet you had an ace, but you had a bad kicker because you were in there and you just decided to fold that. You know, you stayed in there when the ace come down. Maybe you bet. But before the cards are shown down, you fold your hand. Some things look kind of obvious like that. Other times, somebody might announce your cards, and they'll literally hit them right on, especially if they say, like, oh, that looked like pocket sevens. And it's sort of like, well, how did he get my exact pocket pair down?
What color were they?
Yeah, right. you know, that kind of thing. It's also like sort of can be obvious when you think somebody has a flush draw or maybe a straight draw just by the cards that are on the board if you're playing Hold'em. This is a type of thing that, as a poker player, it's something you become better at the more you play. And in fact, the first thing you're going to become aware of as you sit at a table and play, it's going to be when you're not involved in hands and you can see who's going to win the hand, who's going to lose, who's going to not, you can see who's, who, you know, you can almost see the strategy unfolding with other players and you can start to put them on hands. Even if you say, well, this guy's bluffing, I know he's bluffing, but that other guy, I know he's just got a pair and there's high cards on the board. You don't often get to see if you're right, but this is the type of thing that happens when you play where you start to see what other players are doing, and then occasionally you actually get to see it to where they turn their cards over, and sometimes you can be right on with very exact cards as to who was holding what. I knew that guy had ace king, and I had a feeling that other guy had either ace queen or ace jack. You know, a lot of times it's those simpler hands that are going to be the first ones that you'll figure out. The more difficult ones are if people make a weird straight or something like that, but very often people don't put you on those hands when you make those hands. It's usually something a little bit more obvious. But to tell somebody, first of all, the confidence of the other person to come out and say it, you're going to think the person's a fool if they're coming out and saying stuff like this and they're wrong. Because you're going to say, obviously, this guy doesn't know anything. You know, I should be able to kill this guy at poker because he can't read me at all.
So if I really can read you and know that you have an ace king, I should announce that you have pocket sevens to giving you false confidence that I really don't know anything.
Well, you know, I don't know if anybody does that, but you know, it's not a bad thing. But like I say, it's very scary for a player. When I say it's one of the nastiest things you can do, you really put a player off because you scare him. You can scare a player out of pots after that because he thinks you know what his cards are. And he feels like, well, gee, if you know my cards all the time, you keep getting my cards right, and now I raised and you're re-raising me, you know, you must know I have, you know, in other words, you scare a person. And it's sort of like if you can scare a person out of wanting to play with you because you think they're better than you, you think they can read you better, which your friend obviously can read you, you're not telling him what his cards are, he probably can take a lot of pots from you. And, you know, and maybe there's some that he doesn't deserve. He might only be able to read you one hand out of 50, but that one he's going to tell you. And, you know, that's enough to put somebody off their game.
But is it bad etiquette to do that?
No, there's very little bad etiquette at a poker table when it comes to something like that. I mean, poker is a game of dominating someone. It's a game of getting the best of someone. And it's a game of lies. You know, the people who win are the people who can bluff the best. The people who can, if you can take pots that you don't deserve, you're going to make more money than someone who is actually giving up pots that they should have won. And, you know, so poker is in itself, it's not a game of nice guys. It's a game of seeing who can get the best of the other guy. And in fact, if everybody was just honest, it would really be like a coin flip because the cards would decide every hand. And everybody would get an equal distribution of good hands and bad hands, and everybody would come out the same. The good players are the ones who are better at lying, better at scaring people, better at, you know, just say doing things that socially would not be considered very nice.
And there's no breach in poker etiquette to outright lie. Like the same guy will sometimes say, I have a pair of queens. And sometimes he's telling the truth and sometimes he's lying. But there's nothing bad about doing that, is there, if you choose to?
No. And in fact, like right now, I know, you know, a lot of tournaments are making rules now about what you can or can't say about your hand or what you think other people's have in their hands. I disagree with all these rules. I think people should be able to talk about hands, they, you know, whatever they want. They if they want to show one of their cards, they should be able to do it. I don't think there should be... the reason they have these rules is because they're trying to get rid of collusion between players. I think sometimes it might look like players are colluding. And the thing is, I think more often it would look like there's some collusion going on with something like this than there actually would be. If two players are actually colluding, if they have any kind of intelligence, nobody's going to know they're colluding. They're going to be using very subtle signals that don't have anything to do with just outright, you know, talking to players about their hands or whatever. I think that, but I, you know, my feeling is, you know, all's fair in love and war. I think, you know, all's fair in love and war in poker. I think you should be allowed to do this kind of thing. A lot of that is now frowned on in tournaments.
We have about 2 minutes. Now, you write about bubble strategy, which is where players tend to tighten up just before reaching the money, and you write how you should exploit that. Now, my question is, aren't there other bubbles, such as like the end of day one in the main event in the World Series? Players who came out from Iowa want to go home and tell their buddies, I made it all the way through one day. I didn't cash, but I did make it through one day. Or the TV timeout or something, or the final table, something. Aren't there other bubbles?
Yeah, there are definitely a number of bubbles in a poker tournament, and it can be going from day one to day two. And in fact, there's a bubble before you hit the final table, even after you're in the money. This would be especially true if the final table is going to be televised. And if there's only going to be six players in the televised final table, well, then even if there's, say, nine or ten at a final table, believe me, when you get down to seven players, that seventh player is going to feel like he's on the bubble. And so there are numerous bubbles, that you're right about that.
Very good. Thank you very much. This is very enlightening, as last week was too. Michael, what did we learn tonight?
I learned a lot.
I learned you shouldn't go to invite Jason to play poker with you.
But he's always a character to have, and he's still invited to the next one. I learned that there's nothing wrong in doing that, at least maybe in a friendly home game. I don't see it very much in the casino games. And utility theory, and I learned that it's a dead end to be studying these one-card poker games, which I've actually spent a lot of time doing on my own. So,
yeah, and there may be other lessons for that than bluffing. All right, so what's going on the Wizard websites?
Okay, I added a review of the Santa Fe station to my Wizard of Vegas site last week, and we had Jeff Hall as a guest a while back, and we were talking about his new game, Free Bet Blackjack, that just started at the Golden Nugget yesterday. And I'm almost done with my page on that. I was hoping to have it up today, but I think it's going to be tomorrow. So check that out if you're a fan of new games. And we'll probably talk about that more next week. Let's see. And I wanted to say that this weekend, I'm planning to release an applet for the iPhone for video poker. It's going to be like Win Poker, but for the iPhone. It's going to be something where you can put in any pay table, and it will analyze it and tell you the return, or you can play video poker, and it will tell you when you make a mistake, and it's going to cover a whole host of different video poker games, and I hope that once it's ready, my fans out there will fork over $7 and buy a copy.
Now, Win Poker does. There is an iPhone version of Win Poker. Do you have any idea now how yours is different than theirs?
To be honest, they're pretty similar. Mine is going to cover more games than theirs. I'm not saying it's better. I'm planning to price it exactly the same at $7. So, it's a free market, and video poker is a game where I think that software is critical to playing it well, and I'm sure you would agree. So I am trying to just add this product to the market.
All right, next week we'll ask you, if you already have the Win Poker app, why should they get yours? And we'll give you a week to work out that answer.
Well, I can answer it right now. To be perfectly honest with you, if you already have the Win Poker app, you don't really need mine. Mine will cover some extra obscure games, but I don't want anyone to waste their money on my app that's not going to appreciate it. So, but if you don't have either one, I hope you will consider buying mine.
Very good. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else. In June, the big promotion is half-price gas cards for your play. For $25 worth of play, you actually get a $50 cash card. That's 8,334 points. Now, assuming you value Chevron gas cards the same as cash, this is like double points for the entire month for the first $83,000 you play. Now, for those of you who play less than $83,000 a month, this means double points all month long. In the South Point Poker Room, they have a bad beat Texas Hold'em Progressive starting at $50,000. To qualify, somebody needs to be a dealt pair, tens or higher, end up with four of a kind, and lose to a bigger hand. Now, the progressive is split 40% to the loser, 20% to the winner, and 40% to the room. Now, I sent Michael an email asking him if he had time to look at this. Did you have a chance to look at it, Michael?
I haven't had time to look at that in specific, but I do have a page on my website all about bad beat jackpots, and some of the work I've done for the dark side has been constructing their bad beat promotions.
The dark side meaning working for casinos?
Yes.
Oh, those nasty people.
But they have good cookies.
Okay, good. All right. Now, at the Palms, every Saturday night in June, the Palms is having a drawing for a new Honda Civic.
were slightly less than 20,000, and you can take a 16,000 in cash should you choose. Both Friday and Saturday evening, there'll be preliminary drawings at 7. 10 people will be called at each of the drawings. The top 5 of those 10 will get some cash, and all 10 will get drawing tickets. The 20 people from both nights will get in the drawing. The Play, Earn, and Win promotion for the second half of the month features Apple gift cards. So if you need a new Power Mac, this is a good source. You can earn $100 or $50 gas cards 3 days a week for 40,000 points or 20,000 points, respectively, which is worth 0.25%. Since the slot club returns 0.25%, this is like double points there, 3 days a week, up to 60,000 a day. There are signs now at the Palms that their car wash is closing this coming Sunday, June 24th. If you have any tokens left after that, use them for something else. 4 days a week, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday, the price of Palms Buffet went down. If you earn a relatively small number of points and use those points, you get the buffet. And it is a better discount. I usually get a 75% discount given my tier level. It's better than that. All right, now on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, for years, the Palms has offered Megabucks pull. If you either get one or two pulls, depending on your status, and they'll put in $3 or $6 into the machine and let you do it. Now, if the line was real short and I was in there anyway, I would go get my $6. And when they put the $6 in, I'd promptly cash it out. Because $6 in a ticket was worth a whole lot more to me than 2 Megabucks pull. Well, I wasn't the only one who did it, but they didn't like that, so they stopped that. So now they still have the Megabucks pull, but you have to pull. It's special tickets that are only good in the Megabucks machine, and you have to use them. So I will. The free tournament at videopoker.com in June, which is going to start on the 23rd, which is Saturday, is based on the game Extra Draw Frenzy. This is a 6-coin-per-line game where every 3-of-a-kind hand you get bonus hands. It's a triple play, 5-play, or 10-play game. The bonus hands you get include the original hands. That is, if you're playing 10-play and you get awarded 25 bonus hands, that's actually 15 bonus hands plus the 10 you normally get. If you're playing triple-double bonus and you're dealt ace-ace-ace to 8, the correct play in the game, if you were playing under normal conditions, is ace-ace-ace-deuce. In this game, however, you're going to start with the aces by themselves in the hands. And that's just, you're forced to do that. Similarly, if you're dealt aces full, 3 aces and 2 sevens, in that game, the correct play is just to hold the 3 aces. Well, that does not count as a 3-of-a-kind in this game, and so you don't get any bonus hands on that. If you're playing in this contest, play the triple-double bonus. It's the best bet. This has nothing to do with gambling, but I want to talk briefly about an organization I volunteer for. It's called Elder Wisdom Circle, where elders mean old folks. And we're all 60 years and older, and we answer questions sent by emails, whether they're about family, careers, how to do something, relationships, or whatever. So whether you have a problem you need help with, or you'd like to volunteer and help other people with their problems, visit elderwisdomcircle.org. I frequently tell people to go out and hit a royal flush. I was reading a book, and it had the expression, go forth and multiply, somewhere recently, and I thought that would be a good sign-off, because applying knowledge to make money is definitely a form of multiplying. So I was pretty sure the expression was biblical. My best guess is Noah and the Ark. That's not sure.
Adam and Eve. God told Adam and Eve to go forth and multiply.
Huh, I thought it was Noah and the Ark. Okay. Are you sure?
Okay. I will bet you $1.
Oh, I can afford that. Okay. But anyway, I looked it up on Google to see, and they said it was biblical, which is as close as they got. But they also said that in some groups, that is currently an polite way to say, like to say it on the radio, go pollinate yourself. So I guess I'll stick with telling you to go out and hit royal flushes, unless you really start to bug me, and then I'll tell you to go forth and multiply. Next week, our guest was going to be Ann Friedlefton, who is a tax accountant. And Ann got sick, and she's not real sure that she's going to be able to make it. So we moved Ann back a week, and we're replacing her. Our guest next week is Stephen Howe. Who is Stephen Howe, Michael?
Stephen Howe runs the outstanding website, discountgambling.net, which is all about obscure advantage plays, mainly in the San Diego casinos. And this guy is a genius. I have huge respect for him. A lot of people know his website, but very few people know him. And I had dinner with him, some three years ago. So I'm really excited to finally introduce Stephen to the world. And there's tons of stuff we can talk to him about, because he has written about all kinds of unusual advantage play, mainly involving hole carding and colluding.
Good. All right. So we have a couple minutes left, so let's go back to our list of Arnold questions. In a poker tournament, you write about a minefield. What is a minefield, and how should your strategies change during that period?
Okay. To me, the minefield is a time that occurs in a poker tournament when the short stacks start going crazy and pushing all in to see if they can get some more chips. Mathematically, the way I figure it out is I figure out at what point would a player, if he was simply sitting on his chips, never playing a hand but simply putting in the blinds and annies, at what point would he be blinded off?
And sounds like Harrington's M.
Well, no, this is different because you can only approximate this. In other words, the blinds start out at 25-50, and if you figure, well, there's 10 players at the table, we're going to go through the blinds, say 30 hands an hour. Okay, it's going to cost us $75 three times. It's $225 in the first hour. Then the blinds go up, and you add what that is, and the blinds go up. And then you might find at, five or six levels in, if a person had not played a single hand, he would be blinded off. To me, this is a very interesting time in a poker tournament, because every player who is left in the tournament at that point is playing with chips he has won, because every player has put in his blinds and his antes from the start to that point. And this is the point where you see very big discrepancies in the chip stacks. There are short stacks, medium stacks, big stacks, but they are all players who have won chips. And this is a point where the short stacks start going crazy, because the blinds keep eating them up. And I call it the minefield, because you have to dodge a lot of crazy play.
There's a video on YouTube of a guy who folded pocket aces before the flop. And I don't remember the reason, but I think that he was so far ahead that he was just playing extremely conservatively. Is there any situation where that would be the right play?
Well, yeah. If it's a satellite and you're trying to win a seat, and 10% of the players are going to win a seat, and you have so many chips, you go, I know I'm in the top 10%. Well, then I wouldn't play a hand for anything. Why should I give anybody a shot at getting, you know? But normally, there'd be very few times in a poker tournament or any poker game when if it's a no limit hold'em or hold'em game, when you wouldn't play pocket aces. You know, you'd fold them before the flop.
But some people might on the bubble, erroneously, but they
might. Yes, they might. Yeah. Hyper conservative.
Quick question. Why poker? Why did you get out of blackjack and into poker?
I started watching the WPT shows.
We got 10 seconds.
Okay. I just thought it looked interesting as hell and figured, wow, why don't I go try to play this game?
Go forth and multiply your money, everyone.
Go hit a royal flush.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Bye.